We spent the time before the service trying to get our daughter Grace to sleep, so I might speak really quietly all the way through and just see if I can. Oh, she's awake. I can yell. Did she not go to sleep at all? No. Wonderful. So Gemma and I are still in London and things are going well. I'm preaching in our local church now, and Gemma is leading the choir. But sadly, we started this week less well when we were both off ill. And being off ill with a little child, it turns out, is significantly different to being off ill. But like any responsible worker, I rested diligently in bed with nothing to distract me apart from Facebook. And there comes a point when you've exhausted all of your friends' holiday snaps and read every article on the BBC Top 10, when your standards start to drop. And you're lured into the sordid back alleys of the internet. And I'm talking, of course, about BuzzFeed. Now, for any of you that don't know, BuzzFeed is the equivalent of watching static on your television or listening to One Direction. It's just enough entertainment, to be slightly better than staring into space, but only just. And you'll get an idea of what it's like from their groundbreaking headlines. These are all taken from the actual website. 25 truths Harry Potter taught us about friendship. 16 words that have a totally different meaning in Newcastle. And my favourite of today, the 31 most middle-class things that have ever happened. And one of the articles that resurfaces just regularly enough that it's always on your Facebook is a classic, and it's Tattoo Fails. Tattoo Fails. This was my favourite from the article we had. It's the dance hit of 2012. This is the guy from Gangnam Style, which you may remember for being that song that was incessantly on all the time, and it had its own dance, and I can imagine in 60 years... whoever this is, explaining to their grandchildren why this really was a good idea at the time and how it really did make them quite cool. The second one we have, if it's going to work, here we go. Nothing lasts forever, except, sadly, that apostrophe. And the classic, and there are so many of these, but I've chosen my favourite. When you have a tattoo, it is important that you have, is it going to work? No regrets. So, despite these unfortunate examples, tattoos are becoming increasingly normal in society. And what's interesting is how many of them borrow from Christian ideas. The cross is a common choice, often emblazoned on an arm or above the heart. And there are angel wings, of course. Even half-remembered or misheard Bible verses are becoming popular. Here's Psalm 62, on a foot, if I can get it to work. No, I think it may be gone. Can you see if you can get it? There it is. That is not Psalm 62. It says, I am spoken for, Psalm 62, verse 6. Any of you that know your Bibles will know that Psalm 62 says nothing like that in any translation. Now, what makes this interesting for us is that people are borrowing a part of our identity as Christians, and they're using it to create an entirely different one. Lil Wayne is wearing crucifixes dipped in diamonds as he raps about crime and killing people for money. Britain First, the popular anti-immigrant offshoot of the English Defence League, uses the slogan, Onward Christian Soldiers, to motivate their troops to yell at people who aren't white. Paedophile priests run choirs. Militant armies march under God. And it seems that there is a never-ending list of people who want to take just a little bit of Christianity to garnish their own ideologies. The mint leaf on top of the steaming pile of dung. But this isn't always a bad thing. Hospitals were set up and run by Christians long before we had the NHS. In fact, the NHS was built on a lot of Christian hospitals. Sunday school demonstrated the belief that all children have a right to education, long before we had national schools. We have endless charity drives to do something fun and raise money for the poor or the sick. The Christian identity has permeated our country so thoroughly that it can feel like we don't actually have anything to do. How do you express your identity as a Christian when everyone else seems to be doing it already? If you wear a cross around your neck or on your lapel, you're fashionable or you're a hippie. If you give to charity, you're a really nice person, just like Sam from HR, who was in yesterday collecting for a fun run. And if you go out of your way to serve people, then you're lovely and they owe you a drink. So how do we remain distinctive? How are we supposed to be salt and light? Well, the passage we're looking at today may well take the crown for being the most tired cliche in the book of appropriated Christianity. Used at so many weddings and anniversaries and civil ceremonies that even Christians have given up on it and are using something by Beyoncé instead. 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient, love is kind, blah, blah, man and wife, cake, speeches. The chapter, much like the diamond-coated cross, has been appropriated so wildly that we don't really own it anymore. It's used as a piece of beautiful poetry or sage wisdom, a fridge magnet, or a little wooden sign to hang in your kitchen. But actually, as we come to the end of our series on finding your shape as a Christian, this passage has a lot to teach us. And so, as is often the case, we have to examine it anew, and we have to let it examine us, if we hope to find out what makes us distinct. This chapter certainly offers some radical suggestions. Now, there's too much to cover in one sitting. There were two passages we were going to look at today, this one and Galatians. Actually, I'm only going to look at such a small part of this one because I could be here for months and we still wouldn't understand it. So I'm going to focus on just the four key statements that Paul makes in verse 7. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. I wonder what your reaction is when a friend tells you they're about to do something really stupid. How they've decided to get over their debt blues with an all-expenses-paid trip to the Bahamas. Or how they're planning to give their spouse a diet book over dinner tonight. Do you smile and nod? Glaze over in panic? Crack a joke and stick a date in your diary to tell them I told you so afterwards? And how is your reaction different if it's something that only Christians think is unwise? When your teacher friend tells you that they have set aside Sunday as a special day for marking year 7. Or when a friend explains how they intend to wildly play the field before settling down with just the right woman. When people step outside of common sense, the morality of the masses, we're actually quite comfortable in addressing it. Maybe we don't challenge them directly there and then, but we gather consensus among friends. We arrange a serious conversation. But when people step outside of God's commands, we often strike ourselves dumb. People are entitled to their own opinions. It's okay, they don't live by my rules, they're not a Christian. Why would they? And every time we do that, we watch our friends make mistakes. There is a stereotype surrounding Christians that we are the sour-faced grandmother of the modern world, standing on the sidelines of anything fun, tutting, and telling people to go home and call their mothers. Stern nuns still populate sitcoms and murderers punished from the Bible in CSI. But actually, when was the last time you saw a Christian telling somebody what to do? We hide so often from the specter of being declared a judge on our high horse that it seems a more accurate stereotype of the modern Christian would be that of the silent watcher. The dog trained not to bark at danger. And this is easy, or easier. It's difficult to stick your neck out when something is wrong, especially if you suspect that other people won't agree with you. And so we just don't. We raise our flag when common sense agrees with us, and we can enjoy the camaraderie of the mainstream, but when we're outnumbered, we keep quiet. But love always protects. Even when being protected doesn't feel like love. We've all felt chafed by discipline, and we've all been annoyed by a rule that keeps us safe. How many of you have gotten angry at a speed camera recently? Nobody enjoys it, but we respect it because we know it's good for us. We respect it because the alternative is worse. It's easy to believe that if we try and show our friends God's discipline, that they will reject us, that they'll be offended. Meanwhile, bad advice is spewed from every billboard, from every screen, transferred straight into our teenagers' brains from their iPhones. But love always protects. And love always trusts. Now, this one would seem far easier until you consider who you actually trust. Your friends? Yes, most of them. Your neighbors? Yes, until you share a parking space. But would you share a vulnerability with the staff room at work? Would you entrust a job to someone who has let you down before? Trusting is a nice, respectable thing to do right up until the moment when you are suddenly a complete idiot. When we trust people who are seen to deserve it, we are rewarded. They trust us back. You can put your lunch in the staff room fridge without having to put a little note on it saying keep away. There's even a grey area where you're allowed to trust people who are untrustworthy as long as you're doing it in a recognisably charitable way. Taking a child from a broken home or helping at a support group for addicts. However, the moment you step outside of those, your credibility is shot. You took your partner back after they cheated. Idiot. They'll do it again. You told the old man at the school sports day that he could take pictures. Criminally stupid. What were you thinking? You trust the people who deserve it, and you cut off the ones that don't. But love always trusts. Trusts the partner who swears they've changed. Trusts that the old man is a grandfather. When Jesus is asked to set a limit on forgiveness, he tells his disciples to do some mental maths. 7 times 7, 77, 7, carry the 2. We trust because nobody else will. And we trust because we were trusted first. So far, so difficult then. But this one should be easy. Love always hopes. After all, hope is famous. It's been in films. Even when all hope is lost, when the terrorists have taken over the White House and Liam Neeson's daughter has been kidnapped again, what we have left is hope. Of course, hope in this case is that Liam Neeson will get to use his particular set of skills, but hope nonetheless, that intangible, uncontainable belief that somehow things are going to get better, despite all of the evidence to the contrary. Presidential campaigns are run on it. Aid packages deliver it by helicopter. Hope invests before it is safe to do so. We deliver food to refugees, not because it will feed them forever, not even because it will feed them tomorrow, but because tomorrow they might be able to grow their own. We provide opportunities for redemption, not because we're convinced that people are going to be redeemed, but because things would be better if they were. Hope is acting on the belief that tomorrow will be better than today. And hope is lost in so many places. The conflict in Gaza, hopeless. Ukraine, South Sudan, did we really have any hope there to begin with? The pregnant teenager, the rapist, the jihadi returning from Syria swearing that he's changed. Helping the right kind of hopeless is rewarded. But what about those who we would rather remain that way? Try this at work tomorrow. I think we should let the British jihadis back into the UK. I think they've learned their lesson. See how that goes down. But love always hopes. Hopes that peace will find a way into even the blackest heart. Hopes that youthful arrogance will give way to mature wisdom. Hopes that a solution will be found if both sides lay down their arms. Hopes that a teen pregnancy will be the beginning of a wonderful new family. Because the alternative is what? Excommunication? Vilification? Burying your head in the sand? Turning the page and hoping we get to host the Olympics again soon so we can have some good news? Hope is palatable, it's okay, until exhaustion sets in and then it's broken. And we wear our broken hopes like pearls of wisdom around our neck. I was going to be a film director. I wonder what you were going to be. We call it street smarts, or the school of hard knocks, the university of life. We grow cynical. And if we don't, we're ridiculed for it. But love always hopes, because we alone have real reason to. Ours is not a vague vision of the future, bliss, campfires, and kumbaya, but a solid knowledge of the return of the king. When we hope for a change in the darkest corners, all we're really doing is willing forward the eventual. Our God reigns, and his will is good. So finally, love always perseveres. What makes us different? The core of our identities, the truth that everyone seems to want to imitate, is love. We are loved unconditionally, and we're called to do the same. It gives us peace and purpose, self-assuredness and confidence. It gives us strength to take the challenges that life faces, and it gives us compassion to reach down for others. And you would think that this would make us popular. But always protecting paints us as the sour schoolmistress. Always trusting paints us as naive pushovers. And always hoping puts us under the flag of the villains that we defend. So love always perseveres. All of the qualities I've described today are things that are respected and encouraged in society. If we are nice to nice people and trusting to those that trust us, we're just like everyone else, even if we do it for Christ. It's only when others fall away that we show our light. And that might take moments, or it might take a lifetime. But when we do, we are different, with all the good and the bad that comes with it. I'll finish with a story and a challenge. I have a friend at work who is off work long-term sick. He simply didn't come back after the summer. There was no official word about where he was or what had happened to him. He was just quietly replaced. And the rumor mill slowly whispered into action. Maybe he's been suspended. He was quite friendly with the kids. Perhaps he's had some kind of breakdown. There was talk of a card, but what do you write? Commiserations? Get well soon? If he has been suspended, are we allowed to talk to him at all? So we did nothing. Collegiate love in the face of adversity lasted about a week. And now it's as if he died. Another burnt-out teacher fizzles out. But love always hopes. I send him a book or a DVD every week with a little note. I've never had a reply. I send him my best copies, rare films, because I want him to feel valued. I want him to feel like this is not just something I'm doing because I feel it should be done. that my interest in his well-being extends beyond a battered copy of Love Actually. I doubt that I'll see them again, but love always trusts. I put myself in his shoes, and I can't imagine making the long walk up to the school gates, through the mountains of catch-up work and interrogations. Where have you been? But I write a note in my diary every week to bring him something, because love always perseveres. Now, I tell you this not because I think I'm particularly good at loving my friends, but to remind you that there are simple ways to love in a way that is meaningful and in a way that makes us distinctive. To find our identity, to show these pale imitations for what they really are, we must love as Jesus loved. If I put a tenner in the charity box at work but have not love, I'm just an overflowing wallet. If I grow a mustache for Movember and give up smoking for Stoptober, I'm just a resounding gong, a clashing cymbal. And if I love only those who love me, I'm nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Who do you know that needs to see it? Amen.